Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for In the News and American Stories, coming up after As It Is.
Hello again, and welcome to As It Is. I'm Jonathan Evans in Washington. Today on the program, we have two stories related to science. 16 teams from around the world have set their sights on the moon. The teams are also hoping to win the $30 million Lunar X Prize. One team from Germany is close to getting funding for its rover. They call themselves the Part-Time Scientist. Robert Berma founded the Part-Time Scientist. He says his team has been working on its lunar rover since 2008. The vehicle has an adjustable solar panel, which creates electricity from the sun's light. It also has three cameras and four strong tires. Mr. Berma says his team is using parts that were designed for smaller electronics and satellites.
Using technology which is kind of not intended to send something to the moon is always very risky. So we have to really slim down everything so that it fits into this less than 4 tons payload vehicle.
Cost is also a concern. Mr. Berma says his team is making its rover as high-tech as possible.
So what we want to try to do is make as much as high-tech, as you would call it, available for space applications so that you have like more processing power for less energy. Energy is your number one constraint in space. And that really cuts down into our mission costs.
Mr. Berma expects the project to cost less than $30 million. He hopes to have signed an agreement for a launch vehicle by the end of the year. His team hopes to send the rover on its way to the moon by the end of 2017. The 15 other teams in the competition are from the United States and 9 other countries. They are Brazil, Canada, Chile, Hungary, Japan, India, Israel, Italy, and Malaysia. You are listening to As It Is from VOA Learning English. Many processed foods have resulted from the work of U.S. military laboratories. The military's interest in food science increased during World War II, when it sent meals to 1.6 million troops worldwide. Ann Ball has more on the influence of the U.S. military on the food we eat.
Much of the food Americans buy at the store has a secret military history. People in the United States eat more processed foods than those in other countries. Now, an American writer says many foods like energy bars and frozen dinners can be linked to a U.S. military laboratory somewhere. Anastasia Marx de Salcedo writes about food. She wrote the book Combat Ready Kitchen. She says the U.S. military's interest in food science expanded during World War II. At that time, the military went from feeding 400,000 soldiers to sending meals to 11.6 million troops worldwide. However, these foods would turn bad and ruin over time. That led to a major effort to learn how to protect, store, and carry food into battle. The military enlisted big food industry businesses to help produce food for soldiers. As a result, this U.S. military-led effort led to the invention of products like energy bars, restructured meat, and extended life bread. The relationship between these food companies and the military did not end when the war did. The government never wanted to have to go through the experience of ramping up for a World War III should it come along, says Ms. Marx de Salcedo. And so the system where the military, universities, and industries worked together to solve some of the big issues in food science has stayed intact. And from that system, all sorts of processing techniques have come into the marketplace. These foods ended up becoming part of the American diet. And this was no accident. They have a mandate to get the science used in creating combat rations into consumer food items, she says. At a moment's notice, the food industry needs to be able to convert its production lines over to producing combat rations. This effort led to the development of many of the foods Americans find in grocery stores. For example, the military developed whole cheese powder, like the kind often found in boxes of macaroni and cheese. To create the powder, manufacturers removed water from the cheese in an effort to reduce the weight and size of food sent to soldiers overseas. The military also wanted a way to remove water from potatoes. The resulting technology made Pringles potato chips possible. In the 1960s, a technology called modified atmosphere packaging was developed to send farm produce to American soldiers in Vietnam. Today, food suppliers use this technology to lengthen the life of fruits and vegetables. High-pressure processing appeared in the late 1990s. Today, it is used to keep ready-to-eat meals fresh. The next food product Anastasia Marx de Salcedo expects to see from the military is non-perishable pizza. This special kind of pizza would not have to be kept cool before it is heated. The food writer believes the popularity of processed foods has both good and bad effects. We consumers have benefited by having food that is convenient and safe to eat. And it certainly has helped us in managing our modern lifestyles, she said. On the downside, because the military focuses foremost on the values that go into making a ration, which are long shelf life, durability, affordability, and sort of broad palatability, those are the values expressed in the food items you find on our supermarket shelves. In other words, U.S. military-driven processed foods might last a long time and taste good, but they are not necessarily good for you. I'm Ann Ball.
And that's our program for today. Join us again tomorrow for another As It Is. I'm Jonathan Evans. Thanks for listening.
In the News is next, followed by American Stories. You can read and listen to our programs and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is In the News. President Barack Obama announced on Thursday that he will slow the planned withdrawal of United States forces from Afghanistan. The announcement came a day after the president said he would send troops to Cameroon to help in the fight against Boko Haram militants. Under Mr. Obama's leadership, the U.S. has led an international coalition against the Islamic State group for more than a year. Islamic State forces control parts of both Syria and Iraq. Mr. Obama was elected in 2008, partly because he promised to bring American troops home and end the long wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. Many Americans had grown tired of the wars and wanted their sons and daughters who were fighting them to come home. On Thursday, the president said he knows this is still what the American people want.
I know that many of you have grown weary of this conflict. As you are well aware, I do not support the idea of endless war.
Mr. Obama has said many times during his two terms that he wants American troops removed from conflict areas by the time he leaves office. In May of 2014, he spoke to soldiers at the U.S. Military Academy at West Point. He told them that most of the American troops who were then in Afghanistan would be home by the time he left office in January 2017. But Afghan troops have not been able to provide security for the country. On Thursday, President Obama said Afghan forces are still not as strong as they need to be.
The bottom line is, in key areas of the country, the security situation is still very fragile, and in some places, there's risk of deterioration.
Afghanistan's former Taliban rulers and their supporters continue to threaten security. The Taliban has surprised U.S. officials with its strength and ability to control rural areas and launch deadly attacks on cities. So Mr. Obama announced this week that he has decided to keep the number of American troops in Afghanistan at 9,800 through most of 2016. He plans to reduce that number to 5,500 by the time he leaves office in early 2017. At one time, there were 100,000 American troops in the country. 2,200 Americans have died in the fighting. Officials say the president made his decision after months of talks with U.S. military leaders and Afghan officials. Many officials were worried when Afghan forces lost control of the northern city of Kunduz for a short time to Taliban militants. Also this week, President Obama ordered the military to send about 300 American troops to the Central African nation of Cameroon. Mr. Obama wrote that about 90 U.S. troops began deploying to Cameroon on Monday. They will use unmanned aircraft to find Boko Haram militants. A U.S. defense official said that Cameroon invited the troops as part of a larger international effort to stop the spread of violent extremists. The official said the need for international action has, in the official's words, become more urgent as Boko Haram and other organizations ramped up their violent activities. And that's In the News from VOA Learning English. I'm Christopher Jones-Cruz.
Now, the VOA Special English Program, American Stories.
Today, we present the short story, The Telltale Heart, by Edgar Allan Poe. Here is Shep O'Neill with the story.
True. Nervous. Very, very nervous I had been, and am. But why will you say that I am mad? The disease had sharpened my senses, not destroyed them. Above all, it was the sense of hearing. I heard all things in the heaven and in the earth. I heard many things in the underworld. How then am I mad? Observe how healthily, how calmly, I can tell you the whole story. It is impossible to say how first the idea entered my brain. I loved the old man. He had never wronged me. He had never given me insult. For his gold, I had no desire. I think it was his eye. Yes, it was this. He had the eye of a bird, a vulture, a pale blue eye with a film over it. Whenever it fell on me, my blood ran cold. And so, very slowly, I made up my mind to take the life of the old man and free myself of the eye forever. Now, this is the point. You think that I am mad. Madmen know nothing. But you should have seen me. You should have seen how wisely and carefully I went to work. I was never kinder to the old man than during the whole week before I killed him. And every night, late at night, I turned the lock of his door and opened it, oh, so gently. And then, when I had made an opening big enough for my head, I put in a dark lantern, all closed, that no light shone out, and then I stuck in my head. I moved it slowly, very slowly, so that I might not interfere with the old man's sleep. And then, when my head was well in the room, I undid the lantern just so much that a single thin ray of light fell upon the vulture eye. And this I did for 7 long nights, but I found the eye always closed. And so it was impossible to do the work, for it was not the old man who was a problem for me, but his evil eye. On the 8th night, I was more than usually careful in opening the door. I had my head in and was about to open the lantern when my finger slid on a piece of metal and made a noise. The old man sat up in bed, crying out, "Who's there?" I kept still and said nothing. I did not move a muscle for a whole hour. During that time, I did not hear him lie down. He was still sitting up in the bed, listening, just as I have done, night after night. Then I heard a noise, and I knew it was the sound of human terror. It was the low sound that arises from the bottom of the soul. I know the sound well. Many a night, late at night, when all the world slept, it has welled up from deep within my own chest. I say I knew it well. I knew what the old man felt, and I felt sorry for him, although I laughed to myself. I knew that he had been lying awake ever since the first noise when he had turned in the bed. His fears had been, ever since, growing upon him. When I had waited a long time, without hearing him lie down, I decided to open a little, a very, very little crack in the lantern. So I opened it. You cannot imagine how carefully, carefully. Finally, a single ray of light shot from out and fell full upon the vulture eye. It was open, wide, wide open, and I grew angry as I looked at it. I saw it clearly, all a dull blue with a horrible veil over it that chilled my bones. But I could see nothing else of the old man's face or person, for I had directed the light exactly upon the damned spot. And have I not told you that what you mistake for madness is but a kind of oversensitivity? Now, there came to my ears a low, dull, quick sound, such as a watch makes when inside a piece of cotton. I knew that sound well, too. It was the beating of the old man's heart. It increased my anger, but even yet I kept still. I hardly breathed. I held the lantern motionless. I attempted to keep the ray of light upon the eye, but the beating of the heart increased. It grew quicker and quicker and louder every second. The old man's terror must have been extreme. The beating grew louder, I say, louder every moment. And now, at the dead hour of the night, in the horrible silence of that old house, so strange a noise as this excited me to uncontrollable terror. Yet for some minutes longer I stood still, but the beating grew louder, louder. I thought the heart must burst, and now a new fear seized me. The sound would be heard by a neighbor. The old man's hour had come. With a loud shout, I threw open the lantern and burst into the room. He cried once, once only. Without delay, I forced him to the floor and pulled the heavy bed over him. I then smiled to find the action so far done. But for many minutes, the heart beat on with a quiet sound. This, however, did not concern me. It would not be heard through the wall. At length, it stopped. The old man was dead. I removed the bed and examined the body. I placed my hand over his heart and held it there many minutes. There was no movement. He was stone dead. His eye would trouble me no more. If still you think me mad, you will think so no longer when I describe the wise steps I took for hiding the body. I worked quickly, but in silence. First of all, I took apart the body. I cut off the head and the arms and the legs. I then took up three pieces of wood from the flooring and placed his body parts under the room. I then replaced the wooden board so well that no human eye, not even his, could have seen anything wrong. There was nothing to wash out, no mark of any kind, no blood whatever. I had been too smart for that. A tub had caught all. When I had made an end of these labors, it was 4 o'clock in the morning. As a clock sounded the hour, there came a noise at the street door. I went down to open it with a light heart, for what had I now to fear? There entered 3 men, who said they were officers of the police. A cry had been heard by a neighbor during the night. Suspicion of a crime had been aroused. Information had been given at the police office, and the officers had been sent to search the building. I smiled, for what had I to fear? The cry, I said, was my own in a dream. The old man, I said, was not in the country. I took my visitors all over the house. I told them to search, search well. I led them at length to his room. I brought the chairs there and told them to rest. I placed my own seat upon the very place under which lay the body of the victim. The officers were satisfied. I was completely at ease. They sat, and while I answered happily, they talked of common things. But after a while I felt myself getting weak and wished them gone. My head hurt and I had ringing in my ears. But still they sat and talked. The ringing became more severe. I talked more freely to do away with the feeling, but it continued until at length I found that the noise was not within my ears. I talked more, and with a heightened voice, yet the sound increased, and what could I do? It was a low, dull, quick sound like a watch makes when inside a piece of cotton. I had trouble breathing, and yet the officers heard it not. I talked more quickly, more loudly, but the noise increased. I stood up and argued about silly things in a high voice and with violent hand movements, but the noise kept increasing. Why would they not be gone? I walked across the floor with heavy steps, as if excited to anger by the observations of the men. But the noise increased. What could I do? I swung my chair and moved it upon the floor. But the noise continually increased. It grew louder, louder, louder. And still the men talked pleasantly and smiled. Was it possible they heard not? No, no, they heard. They suspected. They knew. They were making a joke of my horror. This, I thought, and this, I think. But anything was better than this pain. I could bear those smiles no longer. I felt I must scream or die. And now, again, louder, louder, louder. Villains, I cried, pretend no more. I admit the deed. Tear up the floorboards. Here, here, it is the beating of his hideous heart.
You have heard the story, The Telltale Heart, by Edgar Allan Poe. Your storyteller was Shep O'Neill. This story was adapted by Shelley Gullist. It was produced by Luan Davis. Listen again next week for another American story in VOA Special English. I'm Faith Lapidus.